Topic for today is, or this evening, is on true love. And I'm sure some of you might be wondering, well, wait a minute, this month's theme is fools. And there, of course, there's that old song that says, only fools fall in love. But, actually, this is leftovers from last month's theme, and I had a couple other sermons I wanted to do, and I said, well, I'll just sneak them in, and then I got sick, and then other things happened, and 2 months later, I'm getting around to taking care of this. A common question that I have received from teenagers, from young adults over the years is, well, how do I know if I'm in love? How will I know that this particular person is the right person? And it actually is a difficult question, because how does a person with no experience in marital love figure out that they have it? Though the answer is kind of simple, because marital love actually shares the same qualities as all the other forms of love. So how do you know if you love your mother or your father or your brothers or your sisters? Well, if you have some idea about that, then you have a clue as to how to love your husband or your wife. If you know how to love your fellow Christians, well, then you know how to love your spouse. Do you love God? Well, then you're able to love somebody on earth. There's a book in the Old Testament that's called the Song of Solomon. And we talked about this book in the past, but it's an unusual book in our Bibles. It's written in as one large poem or a song, composed of smaller poems or songs. It's written as a play. The story is basically almost completely told through conversation. There's very little narration in there. There's almost none. And yet it's also a difficult book because the parts aren't marked. We just have the conversation in the actual text. Now, if you look in your translations, they'll put it in, you know, a little label saying this is, you know, who the translators thought somebody was saying something. But that's the translator's guesses. And a lot of times, if you look at the context and you look at it in detail, some of them are wrong. You know, I don't agree with all of them. But that's why you also will find dramatically different labeling in various translations, because different people look at the Song of Solomon as different topics or different ways of expressing things. It's also kind of like the Book of Esther in that there's no direct reference to God. God obviously plays a part. There's discussions about morality and things like that in the Song of Solomon, but God is not directly mentioned. In fact, there's one spot in there where I think God is actually talking. But again, it doesn't, since it's just conversation, you can't actually mark it as that, or unless you come to that. And what's really strange about the Song of Solomon, we don't even know the name of the main character. Because the main character is a woman. She calls herself Shulamith, or Shulamite, depending on how it's translated. But that's all she calls herself. It's the female form of the word for peace. And it just so happens that Solomon is the male form of the word for peace in Hebrew. So in other words, she's calling herself Mrs. Solomon or Mrs. Peace. But other than that, we don't know much about her other than what she reveals in her conversations. But there are points that are being made in this book that are really important about love, especially marital love. The first point is that true love can't be forced. It can't be hurried. In Song of Solomon, chapter 2, Song of Solomon, chapter 2, and starting at verse 4, we have a scene in which the young woman is at a banquet hall. She's at a social gathering. Now, of course, she's dating the king of Israel. Social gatherings will be big events. You probably have envoys and ambassadors and, you know, princes from other kingdoms there. You know, political talk is the rage in those type of situations. But as she's brought in, as she comes into the banquet hall, it says in verse 4, he has brought me into his banquet hall, and his banner over me is love. The banner she's referring to is an army banner. The ones, you know, the signal flags that they say, okay, you know, left flank moves this way and right flank goes that way. He's raised a banner that's signaling to everyone in the room, I'm in love. And she notices that. He's not that he's saying it, it's just the way he's behaving. It's signaling to everyone that he's in love. And she notices that, and she suddenly gets a rush. And she starts feeling a little bit faint. In verse 5, it says, sustain me with raisin cakes, refresh me with apples, because I'm lovesick. I need something sweet here, real quick. I need some energy. And in her excitement, she begins to daydream of them lying together. In verse 6, let his left hand be under my head, and let his right hand embrace me. Cuddling up, she starts daydreaming of it. And all of a sudden, she catches herself. And the lady who's in the play, because you got to remember this is a play, basically steps out of her role, turns to the women in the audience, and she says this in verse 7. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or waken my love until she pleases. And that becomes a running theme. Don't rush love. Now, you may want to ask, well, why gazelles and why hinds or does? Well, have you ever seen, we got deer around here all over the place. I like to go walking out at Chalco Hills, and you see deer all the time. You go up there and say, oh, that's such a nice deer. I'm going to go up there and give it a, you know, I'm going to pet it. What happens? They're gone. As soon as you start to go to them, boom. Faster you go to them, faster they're gone. She's saying that's the same thing with love. If you try to press it, if you try to rush it, you'll lose it. It's going to be gone. You got to let it develop at its own pace. And this idea becomes a running theme. Because the next time we hear about it is in chapter 3. And this is the night before the wedding. Or at least a couple of several nights before the wedding, the weeks that lead up to the wedding. And the young woman begins to have nightmares. She has dreams where she's going to lose her beloved. And those of us that got married, yeah, I can understand that. You know, I remember right before the wedding, there's all this nervousness about, what if he doesn't show up? Or she doesn't show up? What happens if something happens and we don't get married? You know, you've been waiting for this for so long. And she got nervous. And she's having nightmares. And in verse chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, on my bed at night after night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I did not find him. I must arise now and go out into the city, in the streets and in the squares. I must seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I didn't find him. The watchmen who were made the rounds in the city found me. And I said, have you seen him whom my soul loves? Scarcely had I left them when I found him whom my soul loves. And I held on to him and would not let him go until I brought him into my mother's house and into the room of her who conceived me. In her dreams, she looking everywhere for him. And then all of a sudden, she finds him in the dream. And she's determined, I'm not going to let this guy go. And what she's saying is that I'm going to take him home to her mother's home, and we're going to have sex. And then she wakes up. And she realizes, whoa, wait a minute. That's not appropriate. We're not married yet. Goes, but we're not married yet. And she says in verse 5, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem. She stepped out of her role again. By the gazelles or by the hinds of the field, that you do not arouse or awaken my love until she pleases. Don't rush it. Yeah, it's just before marriage. Don't rush it. See, there's too many people in a rush to fall in love. You know, people in love hold each other tight, right? People in love have sex. Well, it's on the movies. They show it everywhere. So if I want to make somebody love me, I have to snuggle with them, right? Or her. I have to have sex. Then I can lock his heart or her heart in mine, right? Wrong. It's getting the cart before the horse. It's seeing the natural results of love and mistaking it as if it's the cause of love. And when we reach the end of the book, we read of their joy in each other's company and they embrace. And we get in Song of Solomon, chapter 8, and in verse 4, we get the same warning again. In verse 4, I want you to swear, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not arouse or waken my love until she pleases. Well, wait a minute, they're married now. They've been married for a long time now in this play. See, she and her husband have been married for quite a while. They're very comfortable with each other. They're deeply in love with each other. And she's warning the audience again, you can't hurry and force and get this type of love. See, sometimes that's another mistake young people make. They look at the older people and look at how great of a marriage they have. And they think they can have that now. Not realizing, hey, that's who knows how many years into this, and a lot of problems have been solved, and a lot of difficulties have been overcome. And they put a lot of effort into it. Their love fully awakened over time, and they were ready for it. Look at verse 5. Who is this that comes up over the from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Beneath the apple tree I awakened you, where your mother was in labor with you. There she was in labor and gave birth. Basically, she's saying, you know, unmarried women are not prepared for that level of involvement with a man. Not yet. It would be unreasonable to expect such an interaction between even newly married couples. True love grows slowly. And then there's the most beautiful description of what true love really is. In verse 6, She says, put me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. What she's referring to, I got a picture of one. Think of this as a little scroll, it's about that long. Just a little cylinder that you can put a cord through it that's got a little hole through in the middle, or you can hold it with your finger, and you can roll it. And what, back in those days, people didn't have pen and ink to go sign documents. So rather they had a cylinder that was carved with personal pictures and words and symbols that were meaningful to that person and unique to that person. And then you had a document that usually was written in clay. And before it got baked, you rolled your seal over it. And that was your signature. Okay. Or soft wax could be also used for something that didn't have, you know, take an impression. Okay. And that was indicating this is something that came from that person. Seals were valuable possessions. I think the best thing we could probably count it as today is your credit card. You know, you keep track of your credit card because somebody else grabs it and they can buy things in your name. And it's really hard to prove. That wasn't me. You don't lose your seal because anybody could put it on a document and it'd be hard to prove that. I didn't do that. It was your seal. Okay, so a person kept that seal safe. They would strap it, you know, like a necklace around the neck. They would bind it under their arm, underneath their sleeve. Someplace where they wouldn't lose it. To keep it safe. So what she's saying, what Shulamith is saying, is that she wants to be Solomon's most valued possession. We talked about it this morning in the adult class. We're talking about 1 Peter chapter 3. In fact, let's go back there again. 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 7. First Peter 3 and verse 7, you husbands in the same way live with your wives in an understanding way as with someone weaker, since she is a woman, and show her honor as a fellow heir of the grace of life, so that your prayers will not be hindered. And we talked about the fact that honoring there is to say that there's somebody there who is valued. And when he talks about the weaker vessels, it's actually talking about something like fine china, as opposed to a clay pot. The husband should treat his wife as someone he values and is precious to him. Or take a look at Ephesians chapter 5. Ephesians chapter 5 in verse 28. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his own wife loves himself. No one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also does the church. There's a danger when you got a relationship where one side is committed and in love, and the other side isn't as committed. The person in love that may fail to see that the other person's distracted by other people around them. And that can be a problem. That relationship won't last. But as Solomon's and Shulamith's relationship grew, take a look at what happened in courtship. Back at, going again to Song of Solomon, this time back to verse chapter 2, and this time verse 16. Oops. Song of Solomon, chapter 2, and in verse 16. She says, "My beloved is mine, and I am his. He pastures his flock among the lilies." He has to be out where there are other fair flowers. He has to be where there are other women nearby. He's after all king. Okay. And she takes note of it, but she knows how she looks at it. He's mine. And I'm his. Yes, there's other women around, but he belongs to me. Later, after they get married, there's a disagreement that threatens to separate them. And again, she finds some comfort. In chapter 6, and in verse 3, she says, "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, he who pastures his flock among the lilies." Now, you might say, well, she just said the same thing again, but look at it again. If she reversed it. First time she says, "He's mine, and I belong to him." Now, what's most important in her mind is, "I'm his." That's now become the most important thing. And then in chapter 7 is when love really blossoms. They've settled in, solved their problems, and there's a romantic scene that's portrayed in chapter 7. And in verse 10, she says, "I am my beloved's and his desires for me." She doesn't say anything about herself. It's all that I belong to him. She's lost herself totally in him. Take a look at Proverbs chapter 5. Proverbs chapter 5 and in verse 15. Proverbs is written to young men. And there's some advice here for young men. And he says, "Drink waters from your own cistern and fresh water from your own well. Should your springs be dispersed abroad, streams of water in the streets? Let them be yours alone and not for strangers with you. Let your fountain be blessed and rejoice in the wife of your youth. As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress and embrace the bosom of a foreigner?" He's using the idea of water as a symbol for lovemaking. And he's basically saying, if you're thirsty, where's the best place to get water? Well, from your own house, from your own cistern, or your own well. They didn't have municipal water supplies where you can just get, you know, open a faucet anywhere you want and get a good drink of water. If you want to trust water supply, you got it where you knew the water was good. Remember the whole time I was in Valley, you always carried around a bottle of water. You didn't even drink the water out of in the hotel. In the hotels gave you bottles of water every day. You don't drink the municipal supply. Not if you don't want to have cramps. That's think about in the old days. If you want water you could trust, you got it from your own house. You don't go and say, "Oh, I'm thirsty. Hey, there's water flowing in the gutter." They had open gutters and open sewage systems. No, you don't get it there. And it's like, ooh, that's disgusting. It ought to be. It should be seen that way. Rather, you get it from what you trust. And he then makes a parallel to marriage. To say, in marriage, love should be within the marriage bounds. Because you don't know where a loose woman's been. It's not safe. Love should be exclusive. Now, true love is also enduring. We go back to Song of Solomon, chapter 8. We didn't finish all of what she said. Continuing on in verse 6, she says, "For love is as strong as death, jealousy as severe as shield, its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flames of the Lord." You know, when somebody dies, the grave's not going to easily give up its hold on that person. And she's saying that's the same way with actual true love. True love doesn't get let go of the one being loved. In fact, she goes on to say, "Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it." Many waters are a symbol for troubles, difficulties. A flood of trouble is not going to put out the fire of love. And I mentioned before, one of the scenes in Song of Solomon is a disagreement over something that really is a small and, you know, kind of a silly matter. Rather than ignoring the problem, Shulamith's love drives her to seek Solomon out. Going back to chapter 5, and in verse 8, she tries to find Solomon, just basically to find out if she just ruined her marriage or not. And so she goes to the women of the court, the other, because Solomon had multiple wives. And she says, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, as to what you will tell him, for I am lovesick." She's really badly in love with him, and she realizes it. And she's really upset over the fact that they had a fight. Most of that then talks about how the ladies finally convince her, you got to go talk to him. And she does, and she finds out, instead of being rejected, that he's still in love with her. More than she ever expected. In verse 10 of chapter 6, it says, "Who is this that grows like the dawn, as beautiful as a full moon, as pure as the sun, as awesome as an army with banners?" That's how he greets her. That wasn't what she was expecting. They had a fight. She was expecting scolding or rejection or something. And it was amazing to her. She said, "I went down to the orchard of nut trees to see the blossom of the valley, to see whether the vine had budded or the pomegranate had bloomed. Before I was aware, my soul set me over the chariots of my noble people." In poetic form, she's basically saying, "I went down there to see if there was any love left. Did I do such a horrible thing that I knocked all the blossoms off?" And she said, "I went to find out, and next thing I know, he's put me up, helping, prating me up in front of everybody. He's not only there, he's madly in love with me." That's the point that was made in 1 Corinthians 13, when it talks about the love of brethren here. And he describes what love is like. In verse 8, he ends the list of the description with the phrase, "Love never fails." True love doesn't disappear. And I'm sure you've heard people say, "Well, we just fell out of love." They didn't let it grow. Love doesn't fail. Many people, young people see someone and they declare they're in love. But how do you know it's a real thing? We already mentioned, true love builds over time. True love grows stronger. The more you know about the other person, the stronger it gets. What a lot of young people call love is actually infatuation. The hormones racing. And that's not love. That's something that's impatient. It can't wait. But it also ends up fading over time. The more you know about the other person, the more you get troubled and wonder, well, maybe I made a mistake. And that's infatuation. Too many are impatient to invest the time. I had years ago, a young man that came here. He was grieving because his wife left him after just a month of marriage. They had only been married a month and she left him. You know what his first clue of the problem was? He found out 2 weeks after they were married that she had a child. He didn't know. And that she had abandoned the child so that she looked like she was single. He thought 6 months of being together was enough to know her. Of course, he was living here and she was down in Kansas. But that was good enough. He kept arguing with me. He was wrong. Last point we want to make. Actually, I got two more points. Don't get your hopes up yet. Verse 7, Song of Solomon chapter 8 and verse 7. It says, if a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised. True love is not for sale. You don't gain this type of love by showering her with lots of rich gifts. In fact, she points out that her body was hers alone. And she decides what she's going to do with it. In verse 10 of chapter 8, she says, I was a wall. In other words, I was a type of woman that just says, you guys, you keep your distance. She says, my breasts were like towers. She's talking about defensive towers. Then I became in him like one who finds peace. There's that idea of being Mrs. Peace. Solomon had a vineyard in Baal-Hamon. He entrusted the vineyard to the caretakers. Each one was to bring 1,000 shekels of silver for his fruit. My own vineyard was at my disposal. 1,000 shekels are for you, Solomon, and 200 for those who take care of his fruit. She said, "That's basically, you get to the end and that's how they met. She used to work in a vineyard. Her mean stepbrothers, half-brothers, made her work in the vineyard. Had to work outside all the time. But she happened to be working in Solomon's vineyard. He was out there checking his vineyards and happened to meet her. They got engaged. They got married. Now she's looking back and you said, you know what? My vineyard, my body, was mine to choose who I give it to. And then she says, you know what, I appreciate. Most of all, my husband, that's why she says 1,000 shekels for him. But you know what, that grudge I have against my brothers, I owe them something. Because I would not have met him without them. Those entering marriages are offering the greatest gift they can give. Themselves. Solely. Wholly. That's the gift that you have to give to the one you're going to marry. Don't dirty it. Don't damage it. Now the last point. Hebrews chapter 13. Hebrews chapter 13 and in verse 4. Marriage is to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. True love is pure. It's wholesome. It's not about sex. The idea of falling into and out of love is foreign to the teachings of the scriptures. A person chooses to be in love. And that choice sweeps them along, governing their future choices. Now, if you go back to 1 Corinthians 13 again. 1 Corinthians 13. This, like I said, is a description of the love between brethren. But it's a description of all love as well. And as we go through this list, think about it. Can you say that this describes your relationship with the other person? Almost every time when I talk to young people, I say, well, is this the way your relationship is? There's almost always about half of them, they say, well, no, not really. It's not love yet. Love is patient. Love is kind. And is not jealous. Love does not brag and is not arrogant, does not act unbecomingly. It does not seek its own, is not provoked, does not take into account a wrong suffered, does not rejoice in unrighteousness, but rejoices with the truth, bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. How do I know if I'm in love? God describes it. It's not the way it's portrayed in movies. It's not the way you might see people behaving in the neighborhood. People have lost sight of what true love really is. And I hope you'll think about those things. If there's anyone here tonight who is not yet a Christian, there's no better time than right now to put on Christ, to become a part of God's family, to know the love of God. And if there's anyone who is a child of God and would like the prayers of the brethren on behalf, why don't you come forward as we stand and sing the song that was selected.